Welcome, welcome, welcome to another episode of Marvel Cinematic University. I am one of your hosts, Jay Christie, filling in for my co-host, Anthony Canton III, who, as he put it on Twitter,
thoughts
is currently
and prayers,
cooked.
Thoughts and prayers, thoughts and prayers.
Yeah. Salute to my brother with back issues. I hope, you know, he should be back for next week. But just a word of advice, take care of, you know your limits when you're out on a trampoline and don't, you know, but also, of course, you know, he's the washed agenda. It had to happen.
The commitment is real. We got to get this man some adamantium is what we need to do now.
That's true.
Yeah.
That it's so funny, too, because he posted the video of him on the trampoline. But he posted it before he said he got injured. He just put it like, you know, I'm having fun with my son or whatever. And then the next day he's like, uh-oh.
Like,
we love you, AC.
If this was like a brand sponsorship with Icy Hot, like I'd be like, this is some brilliant work. Because it's just like a very casual, not seeing it coming, jumping on the trampoline. And then the very classic, like he did the narrator, it did not go well, with the quote tweet right after. My God.
Don't say that too loud. Shaq's going to make a commercial by the end of this podcast.
Like, Shaq,
on trampoline.
Yeah. Welcome to the MC University podcast. I'm Shaquille O'Neal. Something like that, in fact. Yeah.
Hey, if we had the money, Shaq would do the commercial. I mean,
if you don't have the money, Shaq will do the commercial. He ain't got no general car insurance.
What's the minimum amount of money that we can get Shaq to wear like a patch on his suit on inside the NBA that said MC University? Like, what's the minimum amount of money?
I bet it's lower than you think.
It's lower than you think, right? Right, yeah. D-Palm? Yeah.
I feel like AC wasn't familiar with the trampolines game.
Honestly, yes. I think that's true. Yeah. I think that that's probably true, but AC, you know, obviously we say this all out of love, please get well soon. Bats are no joke, but we're not here to talk about bats.
Honestly, AC right now is listening to this episode on his couch, be like, damn, gravity really did its thing.
Yeah. So we're here to talk about the most recent episode of X-Men 97, Bright Eyes, not the indie band.
Dude, I thought the same thing, Jake. This is why I came on to talk to you about it. I'm so glad you made the reference. Yeah,
it's funny because I'm not even an indie band person, but I just know Bright Eyes. Yeah, that is a Two in America's moment. They're not even that good, D-Palm, but you know that was my first thought when I saw it.
I thought we would hear a song.
Yeah, I would, except I actually just got a notice from Spotify that apparently when we were doing like the bracket recap back in 2020. We did a joke where I played part of Bad Romance, and that just got taken down. So I'm not doing that.
You got flagged?
Got flagged, yeah. I'm like...
Gaga got you?
Damn. Yeah. Anyway, but I'm not alone, as you can tell. And as you can tell, I'm not the normal host, because it's taking me 3 minutes to get here. First guest, we have former co-host of the show, friend always, the man from the Great White North, Rome Dog, Jerome Chang. Jerome, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. I wish AC was here with us, but we've covered that over the last 3 minutes. Thoughts and prayers, AC.
Exactly. Also, returning from earlier in our X-Men coverage, we got D-Palm. You know him from the MTR Network and, you know, tweeting. He's been tweeting a lot about X-Men. He's got a lot of these thoughts. D-Palm, thanks for coming back on.
I'm so glad. Like, just so y'all know behind the curtain a little bit, Jake hit me up like yesterday at like 4 p.m. and was like, hey, AC can't make it. Could you do it? I replied, name the time and place, because you've given me an outlet to talk about X-Men, and you give my wife an experience not to hear about X-Men. So you're a true champion in the Palmer household. I really appreciate you.
Welcome to Marvel Couples Therapy.
Yeah. And last but not least, for the first time, talk about X-Men. He's been indisposed on Thursdays. He's one of the fastest best friends of the show. The man is... In terms of, like, the records of 5-timers club, he shattered it. 10-timers club. Rod Morrow, Rod, thank you so much for coming on.
Hey, thanks for having me, man. I've been missing these conversations because I've been doing our sports show on Thursdays. And so I haven't had a chance to be here, but I've always wanted to be here. So I'm glad you kept asking. And I'm sorry AC is out, but, you know, his loss is my gain.
Exactly. And so this episode, Bright Eyes, you know, a lot of stuff happens in it. But I think that
I misunderstood, but I thought we were doing the draft for the X-Men, and I had Rogue going number one, which is probably not on most people's boards, but okay, so we're not doing the X-Men draft. Okay, got it. Go ahead.
No, 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 no. But right, I forgot to ask you, since you haven't been on thus far, how have you felt generally about this show, X-Men 97?
Oh, this is, I mean, this might be the best thing they've done. You know what I mean? Like, it's honestly amazing. I think one of the reasons that it's so amazing is because it's animated, right? Because with animation, your mind is allowed to have a little more freedom, so they don't have to build certain things that they would have to do in real life. So, like, you know, Storm meets Forge, and they're, like, in love 5 minutes later, and I'm like, that's cool, you know? So like, I think the animation style, the nostalgia for the old X-Men 92 stuff, and just the attention to detail is just phenomenal. And with it being animated, the way they're able to bring in and incorporate other stuff from the comics, movies, other Marvel properties and stuff, things that are a lot more harder to do in the movies. Not that they're impossible, but they're just harder to do. You know, you're not going to get a Chris Evans cameo in Falcon and the Winter Soldier, more than likely, but you can get Captain America, you know, in X-Men 97. So, like, yeah, it's just amazing. I mean, whoever's writing this, I envy them, because just the
what
bar
did he do?
Right, yeah. Like the bar they're able to write are just like, I they stick with me so much. The please don't make me let you down from Magneto in like episode one. And of course, the so many countries allow their leaders to become terrorists. Like, it's just, there's just bars in this shit where I'm just like, bars. Oh, they understood the assignment, and I don't know what Bo DeMeo did. I don't know who he killed or what puppies he murdered, whatever. But like, before, whatever, the show was running great, and the attention to detail has just been so phenomenal. And you can tell they have writers of different marginalizations in the room, because all of these are the allegories I grew up seeing in X-Men. Even when the writers didn't see it, like, sometimes, you know, a guy writing it, he's never had the experience, but he's just kind of hoping or guessing or writing certain things. And then me seeing, like, you know, sunspots, like double, triple marginalization in being an X-Men, being a brown person, the idea of like using these metaphors to like equate to like coming out the closet and stuff like that is just. They're hitting it out the park. It's amazing.
Yeah, I couldn't have said it better myself. But we start off with Gambit's funeral, and we got Nightcrawler giving a eulogy. I thought it was really nice. You know, I actually was kind of moved a little bit by, because I was raised Catholic, and while I wasn't really raised super seriously Catholic, one of the things that I actually always liked about it, even though I didn't like almost any of it, was its emphasis on redemption, and I felt like that was really well put here. And like, you know, I think that with a character like Nightcrawler, I think it'd be very easy to like talk about the ways that his faith makes his life more rigid, but I like the way that they kind of show the way that he has a more comprehensive understanding of compassion because of it. But yeah, I mean, obviously it's incredibly sad that Gambit died. Now, Deep Palm, you haven't been on since, you know, Gambit's death. What did it mean to you to see, you know, this outpouring for him and how everyone responded?
First of all, I'm rewatching 92. So I was watching, I think it's a season 3 episode where they're fighting Apocalypse. It's a time travel two-parter. And he says the line, "The name is Gambit, remember it." And I had just watched that when they called back to it at the end of episode 5, I believe. And I was just like, yo, it was, for me, it was the admission of stakes. Like, I know you guys probably talked about this, but for the first 4 episodes, it was kind of, okay, here's the world we live in, here's kind of this world of acceptance, here's things have changed, and then it's like, things don't change, my friends. Like, they're always like, there's a line, the first issue of Joss Whedon's Astonishing X-Men, where they do an attack on the school, and Emma keeps track of who got excited for the fight, and she said the first lesson is they will always hate us. And the allegories that Rod talked about, that we're going to talk about further, they are so well accentuated through his sacrifice. But also, I loved that scene of them tearing through Genosha to get to the Morlocks, because you see Rogue get pinned to a wall by a Sentinel, and Remy doesn't slow down. because he knows that she's got it. Like, it shows that these aren't just mutants who fight for a thing. These are the superheroes of their race. These are the Avengers of an entire race of human beings on this planet. And so, like, watching them work as a well-oiled machine was so illustrative of their depth of care and knowledge. And then to lose Remy in that same sequence, I thought that the pacing of last week's episode was really smartly done, because you got to see the impact being larger than just us on the ground. It reached as far as deep space. And here we get to see it, bring it back and make it personal with the opening scene of Kurt giving that eulogy. We've got Aurora from the season one episode, because she's one of the Genosian slaves he freed. You got the people from the Thieves Guild from 92. You got his brother, who they brought up from, I forget the name of the episode, but again, from the first series. So I like the fact they're able to mix in these things and these deep cuts and these real reactions to death, because when Jubilee says, how could she not be here? How could she not come? And Logan says a thing, grief is a lonely war, because for him, it always has been. And I love the and we'll touch about it some more, but the idea of found family replacing this thing that they had lost in the world. And it's such an overriding theme for X-Men, for the Summers kids in general, and specific as well. But like the scene where they all show up in Mexico to pick up Rogue off the ground. Like that, I was like, yo, that's, and she's like, oh, your adopted sister, but they don't really go into the Nightcrawler mystique Rogue of it all. It's like, nah, you're my sister because we're X-Men. Like, this is the family. Like, Rogue, like, Jean's got your back. We are here. And when Rogue dropped old buddy and Jean could have caught his ass and didn't, I was like, now that's a family. That is a motherfucking family right there.
Now, Jerome, I know that, you know, like anyone with a pulse, you're a big fan of Gambit. You know, how did it feel to lose him for you?
Yeah, it was weird because, like, we obviously went through it in the actual death in that episode, but then you watch the funeral, and I think that is, like, true to life. It's like, sometimes you don't really believe it until, like, it's really final. And so to see that happen there, and to see, like, such a beloved character go, like, I've talked to friends about the series, and they're just upset because, like, their boy is gone. Like, they're... I mean, we know we're going to see X-Men at some point in a live action form or just like further beyond. And for those of us who experience X-Men the first time around, like, we have been spurned by not being given a proper Gambit. So there is this like level, I'm not sure how it feels for like the guys here, where I'm like, y'all can't take him out again. Like, you owe us a Gambit at this point.
Jerome, I will say this. If they cast someone with your passport to play Gambit, I'm boycotting the movie. If they do that again.
Totally fair. But I guarantee we do. No, that's not. but yeah, no. To that end, and then like everything like the guys are talking about, I think what is so heavy, not just on like the character itself, is like, I've never felt so much danger for the X-Men. I think in so many ways, whether it's been the previous animated series or it's been the movies themselves, like, we have been given the message of the persecution that they face. We have not seen like it at this level. We have not seen actual mutants die. We have not seen them frequently be attacked. Like, I think if anything, and that's like the jarring part and like the incredible part about this series, in that it's like not a children's series, is I was so conditioned to watch them in this form, see it happen, have a couple laser bolt, like lasers hit them, and be like, okay. And then we're just going to check on them. I don't know. They're inside the mansion, just being like, oh, rough fight there, you know? And like, they're just gone. And like, and now we're like facing the aftermath. And like, what's terrifying about it, and like what we find about it, and you'll get to in this episode, is we're just getting started.
Yeah, I think that there's something more jarring in television of a death in episode 5 than in episode 10. Because if it's an episode 5, then that means that, like, oh, so it's not even like it's not like the biggest deal in the world, and that's scary. But obviously, as you mentioned, Rogue's not there. And what is Rogue doing? She's displacing her belief. And she has gone rogue. She decides she's gonna fuck up some shit. You know, and this is where we get Captain America. I saw a great meme that was like Captain America in his own comics, and it's like, you know, a nice guy. And then it's like Captain America when the X-Men are there, and it's I am Hitler.
Right.
Hell Hydra.
But no, so she's, you know, trying to figure out what happened. And there's this OZT organization that apparently has both Trask and Gyrich. But what did you think, Rod, about... I personally was a little bit worried, and I'm glad it didn't really pan out. But, like, there was something where I was like, do we really need to bring in Captain America? I feel like what's been cool about this is it's been, you know, characters that have been new relative to what we've been seeing. But how did you feel like they handled that? And how do you feel like Rogue's, you know, quest is gone? And you can take it further than I did.
Oh, I mean, I thought it was perfect because it was just the right amount of Captain America to let you know, like, oh, there's Avengers in this universe. And the implications of the lack of Avengers at, like, Genosha speaks volumes to me. You know, like, they're not in the cleanup effort or anything. Also, like...
Not even in the help effort, man.
Right. And also, like, Cap ain't really fighter. You know what I mean? Like, he was, like... Like, I don't, like, I know it makes it seem like he's, like, not with the X-Men or whatever, but there's this, like, the fact that he didn't fight her felt like he was like, yeah, that's a good point. You know what I mean? Like, she threw his shield like a bully throwing your football, and he was just like,
dog, he threw that shit 3 yards over, dog. She's never getting that shit back.
He was looking like, I guess I gotta run 3,000 miles to get my shield back.
I'm walking shit.
Yeah. So I appreciate it. Like the I think it was just like a light touch of Avengers. It didn't go deep into it. And as far as Rogue, like you can tell she's mostly angry at like herself. She didn't just lose Gambit and Magneto, but like she kind of put Gambit through the ringer there with the like the dance and the flying and the kissing in front of him and then holding
his dead body.
She never
even told him that she chose him in the end. Like it happened so quickly. Yeah.
So like I think I just felt like her it was such it made sense that her character would be the one to harbor this anger and be like, I'm getting to the bottom of this. Like y'all can mourn, but I'm finna roll up on some folks. So I actually appreciated that. And y'all were talking about Genosha, the attack on Genosha. And I just, as an aside, just had to say, poor Banshee. Goddamn. This man, in every iteration of every X-Men story I've ever read, this man catches the beats. It's just Rod, someone ripping out his larynx.
His power is screaming at you. Nah, get rid of it. I'm with it. No.
Like, he can fly. He can fly, and we don't really know how. It's like
he screams so loud.
Right, but he's just there to get. But like when he's flying, you don't hear anything audibly, right? So
he gets no chance to talk to the manager.
He's like the produce manager of the X-Men. He's just there to get fucked up. That's what's interesting about him is like whenever a writer decides like we want to show how serious this is, kill Banshee. And now that was the first sign that it was about to go down was like him flying trying to rescue somebody. It was like he's dead. And I was like, oh god, that's the canary in the coal mine. They're all dead.
So you're saying in Marvel terms that is always the first declaration of war. We kill Banshee and then
every writer does it. You either take him forward,
Genesis.
Whoa. In X-Men First Class, they killed Darwin before him. So let's not.
Yeah, I mean, so, you know.
No, the guy who can adapt to anything obviously gets killed first.
That makes sense.
And,
I mean, he was black, so come on.
Exactly, I've seen movies before. but no, I think that the bit when she goes to confront Guy Rich, I feel like they have put such an emphasis on, like, I think I've noticed as someone who didn't really grow up with the, you know, cartoons, not super well versus X-Men, is that, like, I was kind of surprised to see how much it feels like in the previous fights we've seen, Rogue doesn't use her regular power as a weapon, right? Because I don't know things, I just assume that that's where she her normal powers, because if I could drain energy from people, that would normally be what I would do. But the fact that she normally just punches and kicks and stuff like that, it's like, oh, she takes this really seriously. And so the fact that in 2 seconds flat, she's like, this glove is coming off, and you're getting your face touched.
Hey, Jake, she didn't even take it off, though. She took it off with her teeth and spit that. She's like, I don't got time to fuck around.
So, you know, Deepam, what did that mean to you? Because obviously it's a big deal that she does that. She clearly doesn't like doing that.
100%. It was, that's the dark side of her power. Like, that's how she got these powers, was holding on to Carol too long, especially even in this continuity. Like, in the 92, there's an episode where they do the Carol Danvers thing and she trapped in my head shit. And so for her to I thought the first statement of y'all got a problem is General Ross being like, this is supposed to hold the Hulk out. This can't stop. She's just a hillbilly. And she's like, nah, dog. I am coming. This is not. She's like, I thought y'all were the good ones. You killed all them. I'm what's left. And I was like, oh, no, please don't hurt him, Rogue. And yes, while Captain America is a boot-looking toad in this continuity, I thought it was really well foreshadowed by President Kelly's conversation with Scott.
Right, yeah.
About, like, bad optics and, like, yo, it's been a week. We ain't going no more. Like, it's when they call off the searches for non-billionaires in the ocean. Like, it's like, hey, man, we just ain't got time for it. Like, we ain't got the budget. Like, it's an election year. And so him echoing that on a more personal level, because – even at his most idealized version of Captain America, he, quote unquote, lets the mutants be themselves and don't want to police them. But at the same time, it's like, hey, man, that was a genocide on that island. Like, that was attempted genocide. Like, that wasn't just like we set up some bombs or like we killed some students. No, we tried to wipe out a race of people on this planet. And because it's, and we'll get to the Trish Tibbley of it all, and because it's non-expedient politically, we're going to pretend like, hey, but also Kat brought up a good point. Like, if I cross the border doing this shit wearing this, it's a bigger problem than if you do. So here's where he is. Like, I like the fact that even like, even as we joke about Cap, he was like, I can't do it, but I bet Joe ass can do something with his address. And so her, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, I think that you're right that it, I like that he is, it's more complicated than, obviously he's being a little bit of a moral coward, but he's also not like, don't do this. He's clearly fine with her doing it to some extent, but I think that that's what it, like, it goes back with the conversation with the president where it's like, you know, they're willing to support mutants up until it becomes too much of an upsetting the status quo, and you know, the parallels to real life in many different things, pick a topic, are stark, and it really is like, you know, and I think that that's kind of what I really like that the show's kind of making clear is like, I don't expect, nor do I really want the show to be like, yup, the message is that the mutants need to kill humans because humans are bad. Because that's, I don't think this, that is a bad allegory. But I think that, like, I like that it's also not true. Deepam, fine, but agree, disagree.
Deepam, I like Deepam.
Hey, man.
Mercy t-shirt on.
Yeah. Then,
yeah.
Yeah.
Not if they shoot first. Mercy has limits.
Right.
But
I think he just turns around and has justice on the back, like at that point.
I think that, like, I don't expect it to be the message of the show, and ultimately, like, I don't really think that that's...
No.
As far as the allegory is concerned, I don't think that that really is helpful to anyone, because I don't... Yeah, but I think
I feel there's, like, an approach where, because it happens to an entire race of beings, that there are some people who take that as the answer to it, but, like... The idea to make it the sole answer and, like, this is just the obvious thing to do from it. Like, that's the kind of simplistic thing that I think, like, 92 series might do, obviously, in a light, like, lighter way. Yeah.
But I think the thing that the show does, which, and Deepam, I'll let you respond to this, is that it doesn't feel like the general approach of the show is we need to kill humans. But the thing it is not saying for sure is that just getting along does not solve the problem. That, like, the status quo itself needs to be upended. And I think that that is an important allegorical thing that, like, because I simultaneously don't believe that whatever insert issue in the world will be solved by people just getting along. I don't think that it is going to be solved by people. Like, I feel like too often in fiction, the two options are, like, evil guy genocide or kumbaya and that solves everything. And it's like, no. Kumbaya is... Because there are going to people who don't want a kumbaya who will still fuck shit up.
I mean, wait until Falcon shows up in the next episode where we actually solve it at that point. Yeah.
I think it's super interesting because the conversation we're having right now is the same one Trish had with Hank on the roof, on the ashes of his people. Right. She's like, he gives the king quote. She calls it out. She's like, oh, great king quote. And he says, I don't want to use up any more of your tolerance. Because at a certain point, like, hey, man, this turn of the cheek shit just got all my people killed. Like, I'm sitting on the ashes and bones of children on this, hey, man, give peace a chance. I don't know if anyone is reading the current X books besides me. I know Rod is probably. But one of the big things is it's not a dream if it's real. And once it's real, it has to be defended. It has to be acted upon. It can't keep being a dream. Once it's tangible, you've got to fight for it. And I think that while I don't think that, like you're saying, there's two extremes, I think that we're seeing a lot of our main characters, namely Scott's militant ass, get into a place of like, hey, man, hoping for change isn't really doing this shit. And while the other way may not be the only way, but like we've tried this thing and it ends up with dead children. And so like at a certain point, you've pushed the quote unquote purveyors of the dream into a corner where it's like there's a line from Scott Summers in House of X where he says, they've hunted me my entire life and told me I was less when I knew I was more. At what point did you think I was going to stop running and start defending my family? And it's like, yo, like that's like, this is, I like the fact that they're making it muddy. I like the fact that they're making it not clear. I like the fact that it's going to spur in a conversation beyond, yo, what a cool X-Men episode. Mm-hmm. The conversation Jubilee and Berto have in the aid line, when I was like, yo, strong guy, like Sunspot will fade you. Please don't talk that greasy to him ever again. like Berto knocks out the Hulk. Like, don't fuck with Sunspot. But when they had that conversation, Bo DeMeo, who I don't know what he did, but he did that shit. Whatever it was, he did it. Whatever it was, he did it. They got video and they got fingerprints. He did that shit.
We've seen them protect people that do worse work. I don't know what he did.
You don't know what he did. I'm too afraid to say what he
did. Yeah, I don't know what he did, but I suspect based on the fact that we haven't heard any leaks that it is probably something that involves Disney employees so they can't comment on it. I don't know anything, but by the fact that we haven't heard anything, it's like it's probably something that there's some type of legal thing going on.
But something that he mentioned about this episode was the conversation. He used to be a frequenter of the Pulse nightclub. And the conversation between Sunspot and Jubilee was a conversation he had in the aftermath of that shooting. Dang. Do you want your parents to find out who you were on the 5 o'clock news?
Yes. Right. That was so powerful.
Man.
Yeah.
And can I just add, like, just to piggyback on y'all's, like, the two extremes. So the thing that I keep thinking, one, the last three episodes are Tolerance is Extinction. So clearly they're going to go right into the wheelhouse of that conversation. And then for me with the X-Men, like I said, I'm reading the current books and stuff. But when they made their own island, their mutant utopia, to me, the scariest the X-Men are as a power is when Charles and Magneto work together. And so to me, the idea of Charles returning back and him and Magneto come into alignment, because the extremes are so cartoonish and garish almost. It's like, they're not really scary because they're not real. Like, you're never killing all the humans, and you're never, because it's just too many of them. Now, I'm not saying Magneto wouldn't give it a shot.
To lay the original allegory bare, the reason why it's ridiculous, because we know it's an allegory, and it's like, there's never gonna be, it's like how racist people are afraid that like people of color are gonna enslave white people. It's like that's just as ridiculous.
But the stuff that Charles and Magneto do when they work together, far scarier. Mm-hmm. Because they're both kind of affecting each other. Like, Charles becomes Charles is a lot more militant than you think. Magneto's a little bit more cunning than you would think. And so you know, them basically like enslaving the world with like by giving them the perfect drug to cure cancer and shit, and being like, we'd hate for something to happen to your shipment, you know, like that kind of shit is the kind of shit that I would like to see. I would love if this kind of has a Krakoa like storyline in it at some point, because I mean, all the key players are there to kind of bring that to fruition. So I think that's interesting. And then of course, as like people in the aftermath of this tragedy, as we watch characters change, watching Beast harden a bit, watching Scott pull off the veneer and be like, actually, man, fuck y'all. You know, it's like, like, now that I think about it, kind of fuck this whole dream. Charles ain't here anyway.
Magneto's got a point. Like, that's what he's saying.
He said it openly. He said Magneto warned us. He said Madeline told us.
How far are we from the Magneto was right shirt? You know, like, that's my favorite version.
We've had the signs over in Genosha.
There's
so,
no way that shirt is not. Rod, you can definitely get that shirt somewhere.
Oh, it's been out.
But I'm saying, how fast? What I mean is, how soon before we get Scott wearing that shirt like he did in the comic?
Oh, my God.
Because Scott was like, he was about it for a while, where he was like,
Revolutionary Scott, era Scott is horrifying.
Yo, I loved him. That's my favorite Scott. I was like, yes, be a dick for the right things. But yeah, anyway, I think that they're going to have that conversation here. And I agree. It's not going to be as simple as choose one or the other.
Yeah. And I think you may bring up a great point that the last episodes are tolerance is extinction. Because, of course, the whole issue with that is that if you're just tolerant, then you're also tolerant of the people who want to destroy mutants. And so what good does that do? I mean, that was the whole thing. I mean, I remember when that kind of became the talking point in the gay rights movement of like tolerance is like the bare minimum. Like if you're tolerant, you're still tolerant of homophobes. So like, fuck you, you know? We then get, you mentioned the conversation with Trish Tilby, which I thought was really illuminating because it was coming from Beast, who is so diplomatic. You know, Jerome, how did it feel hearing that stance come from him? Because like Scott is a hothead in some ways, you know, you can see that happening, but like, I was surprised that Beast kind of was like, even he was done with it.
Yeah. I mean, like, not to belabor like all the things that have already been said, yeah. I think it's as simple as going like, you know, Beast is too smart to not see through all of this.
Yeah.
Like that's the thing for me at this point. And I think he understands, especially because, I mean, compared to all the other X-Men, like he is so visibly a mutant, like for the X-Men. And so like he knows to play his role, to play it nicely. He's called Beast, you know,
yeah.
His whole being is to not be accepted by humanity. Mm-hmm. So I think he's like gone above and beyond. And at this point, when humanity has failed you this much, like the thing is, like, it doesn't even feel like a change of heart as much as like he's known this all along. He's probably faced the persecution more than any of the others. Mm-hmm. And though he thought like the best he could do in spite of it is to be this example. But come on. Like,
with B specifically, as a character, Dr. Hank McCoy, the guy that, you know, the bouncing beast or whatever, his physical mutation is such a, like, it's, keep in mind, he started off looking like a burly human and then he grew out the blue and stuff. His physical mutation has affected him in such a way, like he should be in the tunnels with the Morlocks, but he's out here wearing lab coats and reading glasses and doing science. He's brilliant. But it's also like his mannerisms and the way he talks and the way he tries not to be imposing and threatening. His whole reaction is one that speaks to the Xavier's dream of coexistence and tolerance. And if we show them the benefits, they'll have to, you know, they'll have to capitulate and understand that we're all equal. And, you know, when he gets fed up, it's a problem because, I mean, we've seen every reality where he's Dark Beast. We've seen some of the realities where he's regular ass Beast and he gets the metal because he's sad or some shit. And now you got fucking like him dealing with magic or time travel or some shit. So like that dude being on the edge is such a like telling moment to me because. Mm-hmm. Because he's one of those guys. He's one of them ones where just intellectually he could destroy everything on a whim, you know. So seeing him out of answers is like, oh, that hit me so hard.
It's jarring because he's the one who literally encapsulates twice as good to go half as far. He's the one who is literally a multi-hyphenate doctor. You notice no one on this motherfucker calls him Beast except his teammates. Everyone else calls him Dr. Henry McCoy. Like, he has earned this respect. You know that respect gets you? Stand on some ashes. Like, and that's what he's, and whether he's felt it or known it or intellectually, I'm sure he's known it, but wouldn't allow himself to feel it. But in that moment with Trish Tilby, who literally ridiculed them, like, was talking shit about them on television as his friends were being killed. Like, you know, like, it's one of those things where it's, and again, his mutation, the advances in his mutation were self-inflicted. Mm-hmm. Hank McCoy gained blue hair trying to cure his mutation. Like, Hank McCoy became a furry beast trying to undo this. Like, he knows the path of – and astonishing when he's thinking about taking the cure. And Logan's like, hey, man, a random mutant wants to take it. That's fine. You're an X-Man, motherfucker. You don't have a choice. not right now. Sorry. And so it's like you guys said, it's jarring, and I think it really underscores – how serious everything has gotten and how quickly it's become ratcheted up from Kumbaya in episode one. How these Sentinel parts get out in the wild and, oh, no, wait, things done changed.
Yeah. And so eventually there's the whole bit where this is where we get to the messy corner. As I said before, I think that I need to install a red table, because this is where this conversation needs to take place, where Scott and Jean are talking about Madeline, and all of a sudden now Madeline's a sister, you know, to her, and right. they're trying to find her, and this whole thing was just, I don't know, Jean is not being very clear with how she feels about Scott being in a relationship with Madeline. Not that I blame her. There's not really a roadmap with how to deal with this, but I just thought it was funny. I'm on Scott Jean watch because I don't have the background in the comics. This is the thing that I have latched onto.
This is the least messy version of it. Trust me. Yeah. Sorry, this is the cleanest version of this shit.
Matter of fact, when they pulled up Emma out of the debris for a second, yeah. I just because I've read so many X-Men comics, I had a panic moment of like, oh God, no, Scott. No, this is gonna fuck it. Oh wait, no, I don't think they did that.
Yeah. They've alluded to it though, because there's like some definitely. Of the Emma like grinning in this series that like implies there's some sort of history.
She knew what was up with Madeline and Jean. Like
she was like, watching that shit the whole time. Yeah. Your mind wandered, huh? I like they made Emma a bitch. I'm glad that Emma's still a bitch in the 97. Like, when she's like, oh, I'm good under pressure. I'm like, hey, man, that's my girl. Let her cook.
Anything else? So deep home.
Yeah. And so eventually we then, there's the side bit where, as we talked about, Jubilee convinces Berto to tell his parents that he's a mutant. And I thought that this was really well done because I think that.
The bait and switch was like, that hurt. Yeah.
Because I think that portraying bigotry in its worst form is a cop out because it doesn't often manifest itself in its worst form, especially to the, I mean, like, I actually, because I'd never seen it before, on Jackie Robinson Day, I watched the movie 42, and the bit where Alan Tudyk's character says the most racist things you've ever heard, I'm like, this is so dumb because it makes everyone else look fine.
Part of the movie. It honestly is the best part of the movie. And
it's so crazy.
I'm glad they did it, because normally movies don't go there. They always they do Remember the Titans version, which is not how racism was back then.
Right. No.
It's always like, you boys need to get out. No, some of the white people were just calling you the N-word while you were swinging for batting practice.
They're like, look at these microaggressions. Motherfucker, these were macroaggressions. What are you talking about, sir?
And the reason I love this, it actually inspired a sketch on Game Theory, which is the Bomani Oscars, which was the category was for white actors that actually like fully portray racist people. Mm-hmm. And like, because no one ever respects the roles.
Alan Tudyk. He felt like of all the characters in the movie, I'm sure that guy was actually like that. Because you wouldn't have written him that way if he wasn't actually like that.
So Jake, he was the one that inspired the entire idea of the sketch, right? I write the sketch, all this stuff. They get to his part and they're like, it's too racist. We have to take it out.
If you haven't seen it, I would tell you to look it up on YouTube, but I'm almost positive it can't be on YouTube because it's so racist.
YouTube's pretty racist. I don't know if I love YouTube.
That's true. The thing is, you're right that it is really racist, but like, I'm sure that there's some, like, you can say the most racist thing in the world, but if you don't say a couple words, they won't ban you. But I feel like there's just kind of, or you know, maybe Jake. Alan Tudyk's people is like, let's not have
this. How do you know that, Jake?
We were hoping to get Alan Tudyk to do the acceptance speech, and I was like, he's not gonna do that.
I feel like, honestly, I feel like if you got to him, he seems like of all the people who could have won it, he seems like he might be willing to, because he's a cool guy.
Right. He's super cool. Super cool.
Jerome, you were going to say before I...
Oh, no, I just want to confirm. So, Jake, you're going to actually put the time code of where we can find this scene in the description of this episode? Is that what you're going to do at that point?
It rocks him to sleep every night. He just plays it and just dozes off.
It is on Mac. It is on HBO Max. But no, my point was that, like, that scene is... Yeah. I feel like if you were to have the homophobia equivalent, because that's obviously in this scene the allegory song.
Yeah.
If you were to have that equivalent for Berto being a mutant from his mom, I feel like it would be like, oh, fuck his mom. She's a closed-minded person. That sucks. Like, I don't like her at all. But it's like, no. Because in reality, like for every super close minded, you're not my son anymore. There's a, you know, that's okay that you are that way. But yeah. If you could just don't tell my parents because, you know, they're old school. And
what's that line from X2? Have you tried not being a mutant? Like that's
And I liked it too because like everything he had said about his mom, nothing gave the impression that she was like, you know, Rogue's parents. Like it wouldn't even have made sense because he had talked about her already and he just made it sound like uncomfortable. He didn't make it sound like, yeah, so my mom hates mutants and is a huge but we can't tell her. It was more like, yeah, I mean, why should I tell her it's crazy? And I also love that when he said, he's just like, you know, Jubilee's prepping him like, just do this. You know, what's that? And he's like, I'm a mutant. And she's like pouring her tea or whatever. And she's like, yeah, okay. Yeah, that makes sense. You burned down six mansions before you were 15. So we kind of figured something was up. Anyway, don't fuck up the shareholders meeting. So just keep it to
yourself. Yeah, that's what it is. That's crazy. It's like, it's honestly the family equivalent of like, hey, it's an open secret that Rock Hudson's gay, but obviously you can't say anything because MGM, but they lose so much money, you know? Right. And I think that it's, I really like, I think we're talking about this. I really like that it's showing the nuances in these allegories. Because while you brought up that line from X2, the subtlety of the metaphor in X2 is as subtle as a brick through a window. I mean, the sex offender that directed that movie is not exactly a subtle filmmaker. And, you know, also, I'm really excited for the X-Men to join the MCU because I really want the ratio of X-Men movies that are directed by sex offenders to go under 50% because it's above 50% now. And so I would like there to be more than two X-Men movies that are not directed by sex offenders. That'd be very nice.
The fact that it got it was veering away, it was not. And it's like The Return. And we're like, oh, no, we weren't supposed to go back.
Anyway, so that scene, you know, obviously interesting. And then we have the bit where Trask sent a message to, former University of Florida quarterback Kyle Trask sends a message to the X-Men, sending them to Madripoor. I think that every time I hear that name, because I'm a Florida fan, but the Madripoor, the fictional city, and Rogue happens also to be there because she knows to go to Madripoor as well. And this is where we get the scene that Deepam, you mentioned earlier about the family. And I thought that this was really nice. And I'm a huge fan of found family stories. I think that it's weird because like I'm very, very, very close with my family. And so it's not like I have that my experience in my own life. But I think that there's something beautiful about, you know, the bonds we create with one another. I think that as someone who's not religious, I think that that's kind of why we exist on Earth. And I think that when that's portrayed in this way of like the meaning of all this to them is like, obviously they care about the larger political context of what it means for mutants, but I like that they center these relationships because what makes this feel important is that if they care about each other, that like they want to protect mutants because the mutants are their brothers and sisters, you know? Yeah. And so, yeah, Deepam, how did that, you know, feel to you as someone who's been an X-Men fan forever?
As someone who's also not religious, but I also perform wedding ceremonies for my friends. I've done 9 weddings, no divorces. Don't fuck up my numbers. But one of the lines I say in every service is your friends are the family you've chosen. And somewhere along the way, I've chosen very well. And I think that, like you said, that's kind of why we're all here, to get through this stuff together, brothers and sisters, and united and surviving however many years we get on Earth. And so seeing that, like you said, the micro version of the macro idea of them coming together to surround her in her time of need, and also in the global time of need for mutant.
Exactly.
Like, I think this ends with them reopening the school. I hope this ends with reopening the school and all that fun stuff. And we get a
reopen the school.
Well, even President Kelly said, their other nations are refusing the mutants to come back. They won't let the survivors come back where they came from. And so hopefully this, I hope this ends with like Grant Morrison 2001, like Black Leather and all that fun shit. But like you said, it's found family. It is, but it's a larger connective tissue that I think kind of unites the different, Rod made a great point earlier. It's so many different allegories rolled up into one. You can pick and choose. Or you can say, holy shit, we're all in this fight together. Yeah. Like, I think that's really the larger meta point.
Yeah.
I think there's an added layer to it, too, where it isn't just, like, the history and the found family that they have, but the trauma that they just went through.
Yeah.
Like, there's this element, too, of, like, they all know what Rogue probably did. And beyond the idea of like you're always one of our own, there's just like this feeling of like we support mutant rights, but we also support mutant wrongs at this point. Like there's that bit there where they're like all smiling at her, like we all know what we're about to do. Like, so
it's like me with black quarterbacks before like 2015. Like I was like, Akili Smith's got it, y'all. Y'all don't know.
Oh my god, that's. I the fact that Jalen Daniels is going to go above Drake May, a 6'5", 250 white guy.
The fact that they're like, they're white guys on television, like, yeah, Jalen Daniels. I'm like, what's happening here?
It's really,
I'm scared.
It's great. But yeah, so we're recording this on the night of the draft, obviously. Now they, as you mentioned, they're going to do some mutant wrongs. And so I was kind of a little bit, just because they kind of speed through, like, I don't really know all the stuff with the Sentinels and what have you. Rod and Deepalm and Jerome, what exactly do they discover in Madripoor? Because I'm kind of like, I kind of get it, but I can't recap it myself. And if there are other people who are half confused, like a potential guest that I reached out to who's busy tonight, what explain to me what exactly they discovered.
If I could step in first, just because I know you guys actually have the answer, and I am closer to Jake than I am to you guys in terms of knowing what's going on. One... I mean, shit's about to pop off is clearly what's happening right now. That's the first part. Two, it would have been one thing if it was like we figured out how to also mutate other humans in a way to combat them. But that's not what's going on here. They are building something as strong, but in a complete anti-mutant way. I don't really know. And I think the beauty of it, too, is like, I think it must be like such a thrill for people who know the stories and know the comics about like what's about to happen. And then also you do get spoiled if you just read the captions and you see the name Bastion like continually be shown as it's being taught. And I'm just like, who is this? Like, what is going on? I also wonder, is this like the villain from Beauty and the Beast? But that's Gaston. That's way different.
Mm-hmm. But in Kingdom Hearts, the Beast is in Hollow Bastion. So that's where you got confused.
There you go. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. But like, clearly, I mean, they've already done the bait and switch. They made it seem like it was supposed to be Mr. Sinister this whole time. And then now there's this other thing with the OZT, Ozempic team out here. Like, I don't really know what's happening, but I'm excited about it because it's all like, I mean, we already had a genocide in Genosha, and I'm still sitting here like, what the fuck is going on?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and I'm
going to
ask you guys, what the fuck is going on?
I don't know how much is like spoiler level stuff and how much is like, you know, just general stuff to talk about.
I mean, I don't want a full explanation of Bastion necessarily, because I looked it up and I know, I feel like it would be fun for other people to figure out.
Right.
Okay. Can I ask a couple questions?
Yeah.
And then maybe this will. Okay. Yeah. First, like, we're not supposed to know at this point in the history of any of the shows or the movies who Bastion is. Is that first to start off with? Like, has Bastion existed in any form?
It's going to tie back to things that have happened in 92.
Sure.
But this is the first appearance of Bastion. This is, I imagine they're going to give us the origin story the next three episodes. It's the same reason I didn't talk about the adversary last time I was here. I was like, I don't know what they're doing with it. I don't want to spoil any of that. I do want to say this. In 1996... I was 11 years old and I started doing jobs around the house, getting an allowance. And that's the first year I started buying comics for myself. The big summer event that year was Onslaught, and it was fucking awesome. I've got foil covers and boxes somewhere right now. It ends with the X-Men being the only heroes left on Earth and then being blamed for the death of all the other heroes. 1997, I'm 12 years old. Second summer, a little money in my pocket. OZT happens. Operation Zero Tolerance is what it's called in the comics. They'd like Friends of Humanity. They like to tap down some shit for the show. I'll say this. It's the first crossover I bought with my own money. Mm-hmm. It is the crossover that maybe an Iceman fan. I don't think they're doing that here, clearly. But it's also came out in the summer of 1997. Like, they called their shots on a lot of fucking levels here to the point where I'm like, I don't even want to speculate what these next few episodes are going to be. I have tons of ideas. Like, there's so many things to unravel from this third act. When Trask, first of all, if you've ever read, like, the Stan Lee, Jack Kirby issues, Bolivar Trask, he's the first adaptation I've seen it, but in the comics, he's immediately regretful for inventing the Sentinels. He makes the Sentinels and is like, oh shit, I fucked up. Oh shit, I fucked up. Like, so seeing him regretful here was like, okay, that's tying back.
Even using that quote, you know, of I've become death, like even that, such a like it immediately lets you know he regrets being a pawn in what is about also, what is the genocide of a race.
Based on how long it takes to make animated shows, this had to be written over a year ago, if not more. And like, on top of the prescience of like, just to put it plainly, the, you know, genocide storyline being relevant, the fact that they make an Oppenheimer reference, and like, they had to have written this before Oppenheimer became one of the biggest movies ever. Like, it's crazy how many
But you gotta understand that's the reality of a lot of marginalized people. Like, the idea of like of people saying, "Oh, we're doing this against you." Oh no, it's being weaponized. Like, that's happened repeatedly over history with these things, and so it is. One time, yes, it is very timely because Oppenheimer came out, but two, it's like it's always timely, which is sad.
No, I'm not saying that they. I'm trying to say is that it feels like normally they would explain it more, but it's like now they don't need to because there was a $900 million movie that explained it properly.
100%. But I love the fact. Go ahead.
I was gonna say the other thing too is he's not just regrettable. He's about to like off himself. Like, he called them there to give them the warning of like, yeah, so that was part one, and it's finna get way, way worse. And I'm so sorry. I don't even want to be here. You know what I mean? Yeah. And to the point where like Rogue stops him from killing himself, only to be like, yeah, I'm gonna need some more answers, Playboy. And when he's like, that's all I got, she's like, all right then, peace, and drops him. And there's multiple X-Men that have the power set to save this man, and multiple of those X-Men are like, yeah, all right then.
Rob Jean catches a building like 5 minutes later. She couldn't have got that man.
Kirk is a whole preacher that can teleport. This man was
in that case, like, don't you feel in that case, Rod? Like, that's where we're at. Like, we just came off of the, like, all, like, cut to all of them looking lovingly toward Rogue, toward, like, in terms of, like, we support you, we're your family, to basically the exact same scene and sequence where Rogue lets a man fall to his death and cuts them being like,
one character was like, so we just killing people? Like
it was Morph. Which is wild, like, wild too.
We just killing people now? Like, why? What?
Well, like, this is like the next level real. Like, we've been talking about like the trauma that mutants have faced in this series.
Right.
And like, we'd at least go as far as saying like, okay, for all that they're going through, it's going to be real. Once we see mutants get killed, they're killing now. Yeah. What the hell? That's going on.
The other thing, I'm only bringing this up because it don't seem like they're going to be able to do this in the show, but maybe I'll be wrong. In Operation Zero Tolerance in the comics, there were people, much like Trask, turning into Sentinels.
And what I got.
Yeah, and so the people, like, you could tell Trask didn't know he was a Sentinel. He gets activated by the threat of death or whatever, or, you know, by the machinations of Sinister and Bastion, whatever. Like, but he, boom, Sentinel. And like, you could see he was a beast. He was like, just because he wasn't a building tall, but it took several X-Men. He was, what was he saying? Like, mutant negated or something? Like, he
wiped them all out.
Right. He was wiping their ass out. And so, that at least in the comics, I just remember like there were many people like that, and that is such a fear, because it's a horror on two levels, not just to the mutants but to the people who unknowingly were turned. And I remember, like I said, they probably will not have time for this, but I remember in that run,
I mean, they also have another season. Or do they have another season?
Yes, they do.
They're nearly in the production on season 2.
D-Palm, I remember in that run, one of the most horrifying moments was when there were people that thought they were getting like organ donations or something like that. And Bastion transforms them and they're not finished. Like they're 44%, 33% Sentinel. And it like messes up their bodies. They have to fight. The X-Men have to like kill them. It's like, so like that, so this storyline can get so much darker depending on how they flip this.
The MCU needs body horror. That's been saying this. I know they're not gonna do it, but the MCU needs Jake, body man, horror.
Dude, you might get it, bro. Like, be careful what you ask for, because I read those.
No, comics. I'm not, because my body horror is free. That's like, what's my number one note on Multiverse of Madness? Body horror good. Like, I don't really, right. I'm pretty clear.
They're gonna bring in Al Ewing for season two instead of Bo DeMeo.
Yeah. That's not funny. That's not. If y'all don't know, Al Ewing needs a fucking hug, and like maybe a preacher. Like, Al, that's not a funny thing to say, Ron. No, I don't
I'm
know
just, I'm just
what you just
deadline,
said.
A deadline announcement that the OCE storylines can be done live action by David Cronenberg. Wow, I wow. didn't know he could do superhero movies. But no. So yeah, I think that's really interesting, and I think that there's also, and I'm assuming that this comes up in the storyline you're talking about, a very interesting thing about how, since most mutants are not like Beast or Nightcrawler, where you can't tell that they're mutants, right, that they're sort of a thing where now mutants have to look at people and they don't know if they can trust, if they're
exactly.
Right.
And
but that's like, the same thing. Yeah, they've always had to look at like, yo, do you hate me because of my genes? Yeah.
But like, it's like now, are you? Yeah.
In at least in the comics, the technology worked by being activated by sensing the gene. So like, you ain't even got to know you're a mutant. And it's flexing on you. Like, it was some real scary shit. That was, it wasn't my first crossover D-Palm. I think my first might have been Executioner Song, but it was one of my first. And this is one of those storylines I've never forgotten and always wondered why it wasn't adapted. And seeing it get adapted, I've just been smiling every week, knowing like possibly what's coming. And so it's really like, I didn't even realize what you said, that it's literally 97 when that series comes out.
I looked it up this morning. Yeah, I was like, when did this come out? Like, oh no.
Yeah.
So they've like, so okay, you're saying D-Palm, basically what is going on is like, they've been telling us this whole time in the title what we were about to get.
Yeah. They've very much called their shot. They very much opened it up for us. Yeah. I honestly, like Rod, I didn't expect them to do it this deeply or this intently. And before we get out of here, I just want to say one thing. Like, for him to say the bar, hey, orphan, how's it feel like the future left you? And then to have literally your son from the future save your life after that line, I was like, the future didn't leave you, Scott. Like, and like, God, the fact that they've, like, Rod and I were joking on Twitter when this started. It's like, hey, man, y'all going to need a syllabus for this Summer Family Tree. And they tightened that bitch up real nicely. I'm very impressed.
Man, put some respect on them summers.
I was very impressed.
Well, one of the co-writers on the show was Maury Povich, just to keep like, all the family members together.
Yep.
Yeah.
He was a consultant.
He got shit on Chris Claremont's weird ass.
I don't know if we're about to wrap or like, not, honestly, but I did want to mention, because I wasn't here last week, I just want to say, Charles Xavier is such a fuckboy. And
oh my God. I don't know if you listened, but we got into it.
I'm so sick of this dude. He really was chilling with the colonizers. He know better than that. He know the Shi'ar evil. Oh, they can force
him. If he didn't know better, he wouldn't have done it.
In Xavier's defense, which isn't real, in his faux defense, we're dealing with a lot of media right now, Rod, that's putting Xavier in a very bad light. Like, the end of the fall of Krakoa is not going well for Chuck. Like, Chuck's not doing great on any level in
Chuck,
any
Chuck
medium
gonna
right
have
now.
To go, he gonna have to go on Club Shay Shay to explain this shit with no challenge. I was so mad at him. Like, when he goes, I forgot my power, I'm like, bro, you've been letting them colonize people knowing you could just sit them in the classroom and teach them that colonization is wrong. That seemed like 101 for Mr. Anti-fascism.
For Mr. Rich Guy Orphan? Come on. He had to learn that shit. He had to figure that shit out in the class. He didn't learn that.
That's the thing, because everyone tries to give him that excuse, except he's the MLK of mutants. So you don't get to be like, oppression real bad. For y'all, you know what I'm saying? Nah, bro, you got to stand up, even in another world.
He went to Storm, who was being worshipped as a goddess, and said, you're not a goddess. You owe your life to me and these people, not those people. Nah, he's been a colonizer in a different way.
I got smoke for Storm, too, because she really was ready to give it all up for Forge. And I'm like, ma'am. You gotta pay attention.
But yesterday he made bison. He made bison chili. I think that you're not.
Red
you know,
flags.
I mean,
red flags.
You never had bison chili, Rod.
Man got a picture of him with two of the biggest genocide people on his desk, Dan. Thank you, I'm just saying.
I said that on the podcast. I was like, guys, that was a picture of Bastion. They were like, who's that? I was like, it probably won't come up this season. We're fine. Just a little Easter egg.
I'm sorry, I don't care what Lalandra got. I don't care what Forge got. There's nobody that should be able to dick you down out of your mutant principle.
Them hollow bones be hitting, dog. Them bird folks be hitting.
The thing is, always watch it. It feels like history is littered with that, though. Like, I know you're saying that, but, like, am I wrong? Yeah. I feel like so many people have been brought down. And I don't like those people, too,
Jake. Jake, I don't like them
either. I'm just saying.
Yeah.
Jake, now since you just, like, brought back that episode and we're talking about it, and I confess, I didn't get to hear the last one. Obviously, they gave Charles prosthetic legs. Did you cover in any chance if Lilandra provided him with any other types of prosthetics?
No, we didn't. But this is the thing that's crazy. That's a good question. But he still has a penis. It doesn't.
I'm just saying, like, if she's out here trying to enhance Charles for the betterment of her life.
Yeah, like, it's like, do the legs
walking?
Yeah, it's like, do the legs allow him to get an erection and use it? That's a good question.
Yeah.
The thing is, Drum, I actually forgot to tell you this. A huge upset, because you would have thought that you would have said this. Another person, our guest last week, Kevin Chuklet, was the first person on the pod to say his name is Professor X, not Professor Sex, which feels like a thing you would have said.
That's good. Yeah.
It was because my whole point was that, like, Charles just does not seem like a dude who has sex in this. He just does not give up that vibe.
Right.
Anyway, but no, the way the episode actually ends, though, is that we have Mr. Sinister, who we thought is the big bad this whole time, and then we meet Bastion, and then we see that Magneto is still alive, which obviously he was, because no body, no death.
Nobody, yeah.
And so we're left off
Was it Reservoir Dogs shout out?
I know, yeah.
That was very Reservoir Dogs.
Now I'm going to hear Stuck in the Middle with you every time I watch this episode. Yeah, thank you, Rod.
Like, it was Purple People Eater, but if they didn't. Like, I guarantee you that was the inspiration.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, because he obviously needs to shave, you know. And I mean, at least he provided him with a warm towel, because he didn't need to do that. You know, open up the pores, make it a little smoother. you know, shaving cream would have been nice, but at least he gave him that.
Thank you, Jake. I was like, Bash is not that nice. Like, you I know. Grab some Gillette.
Because I shave every other day, I just shave in the shower without shaving cream, because I don't have enough. It's not really a problem. But
Rob, when you shaved your mustache, how did you do that? Did you do that without?
Oh, that was clap. Drone, look it up if you haven't seen it. He shaved his mustache. He looked like a black Republican, is what he looked like. I'm sorry. Yeah.
I look like Uncle Ruckus, and I didn't find it funny at all for about 3 weeks.
No relation.
Yeah, exactly. I was gonna say also, like, Bastion shows that he's been able to surreptitiously get information on Charles and fucking from the how? How is he able to?
I am, also, how does he have the same angles as the show?
Right.
He said his people had recovered a satellite that they used to communicate with the Shi'ar. So right. Presumably, no, it had the.
Having that info and the world not having it, no government having it.
Mm-hmm. Not yet. So the final three episodes is going to be their larger plan, which is part of it is turning public, like we saw with Orcus, turning public sentiment against these mutants. Yep. They've been lying to you. They have telepaths who can control what you think and feel. Do you really love mutants, or are they telling you love mutants?
And like, I'm so
sowing that doubt.
I'm so excited for the idea of Angry Charles returning. Because angry, right. Like, Charles got to get a little bit more militant. You can't be palling around with these motherfuckers, bro. Like, I need him to show up ready for that action. And, like, they really did that last episode. Like, at least he learned his lesson enough in the end to be like, no, take me home. I'm a proud mutant. I will not erase my brain for y'all. And I was like, yeah, what the fuck was wrong with you? So, like,
what took you so long to get there?
Right.
Tail be hitting. I'm telling y'all.
Yeah. That's the thing.
Also, the thing, Rod, you're like questioning about how he got access to it. There is nothing more 90s than getting access to an illegal satellite feed.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah. Nothing.
Yeah, he knows the guy with shit right there. That's how I watched all my WCW back in the day. You know, right?
Like, the thing is, it's just like at that point, Bastion was showing like his Xavier feed, but if you like just went a bit to the left, he also got free porn, which is pretty awesome at that time.
It would have been awesome if he did free porn, but the free porn was still squiggly lines that only everything.
What if it would have been back there with an AV cord? Like, can you see it now?
He's
making real sinister at that point. Like, the thing is, though, you can't change the channel, because if you do, we might not get it back.
Yeah, but it's also, it's like, it's not like porn. It's like this softcore on Skinamax, like that
time. Yeah.
It's like, yeah. I've seen this one before. She takes her top off 20 minutes in. We got to wait, but it's good. It's worth it.
You can hear the audio. It's just the video.
You can hear it.
Yeah. Fun fact about her, she actually is dating Gene Simmons from Kiss.
I thought about pulling that specific too, but I'm like, no one cares. But, there we go. And with that, with the Shannon Lee Tweed mention, I think we're good for this episode. What are your final thoughts, guys, on this episode, or anything, any impressions you want to do?
It was a great episode. I don't know where we bounced back.
You
from
can just say no. We've been going for an hour, and I want to thank you guys for coming on.
My final thought is I kind of wish that Kirk was a Baptist preacher. You know, like, I understand you identify with the Catholicism, but I feel like he would have made a hell of a Baptist preacher, especially with the powers and all
with
that.
With a German accent?
Yeah. Oh, he could have did it, dog. He could have did it. I feel like he got it in him.
Living testimony.
Right.
when he gave that damn... Sorry, default. When he gave that eulogy, that last line, when he said he was bluffing, I said, "Ooh, Kurt, okay, you... Maybe you need to show up at the AME Zion. Maybe we can work with you over there."
Kirk for get this building built in a week.
Right?
The whole building fund gonna be taken care of.
When we hit that brothers and sisters, everybody gonna be like, open up the wallets, guys, pass around the plate.
I hate you.
I mean, low key, he kind of count as inclusion. I feel like Kirk kind of black. Like, I feel like
he blue, his mama blue, he blue.
I feel like he could roll with us if he wanted to. So I wish Remy would have been alive to introduce him to the Southern heritage a little bit more, because he could have gave us something.
I mean, there's a lot.
I can't top that final thought.
Yeah, Remy's food, Kurt's food, a lot of sausage involved. Don't be just saying. Food will bring us all together. And on that note, I'm gonna go in reverse order, Rod. Where can people find you, see your thoughts, all that?
Yeah, the Black Guy Who Tips podcast is where you find my thoughts. And me and my wife do a show about 4 or 5 times a week. And it's comedy, pop culture, and current events and all that stuff. So you can find me also on social media, Rodimus Prime on Twitter, and Rod TBGWT on Instagram.
And D-Palm, where can people find your stuff?
First of all, thank you for having me again. I'm not quite a Rod luminary yet, but I hope to one day achieve Rod status. Mm-hmm. You can find me on the Twitter and Instagram at dpalm66. Follow all my stuff over the MTR Network. The sports show is coming back on Tuesday. We're going to do a draft recap with Rich Fan, and we're going to be covering all the NBA playoffs as well. I had to take some time off because my son is 8 months old, and real life is crazy.
Mm.
Send him to the future with
congratulations.
If my son showed up with a metal arm and like and standing like a foot taller than me with big ass arms, I'm like, hey,
I love how he called it.
He took my shit and stride like a champ.
Dog, when your 50-year-old son calls you dad, it gotta blow your mind.
They've been fucking with Cable for 5 seasons, and not once did they give like, "By the way, Scott, I'm your son." Like,
Cable's like, "Not now, Dad. We'll do sentiment later." Like, damn, bro, you're 50.
Oh, better yet, looking Gene dead in the eye, "You're not my real mom." Hey, man, relax. You go to therapy in the future or some shit. Damn it. Relax, Cable.
BetterHelp.com.
God damn.
Exactly. And Jerome Rome Dog, the one, the only. Where can people
see? Yeah, you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Black Dragon Roll. You can see some of the work I do with the podcast No Dunks at No Dunks Inc. on Twitter, Instagram, TikTok, and YouTube. Definitely check them out.
One of the greats, one of the legends. And you can follow me at the J Christie. Listen to the podcast Love at First Psych, where we talk about the United States Original Series Psych with Andre Barrera. And for this show, follow the show at MC University Pod. And if you like this show, and you're like, when we get silly, please consider supporting our Patreon for $3 a month. You get all of our episodes for $3. You get access to a Discord where we have a lot of great X-Men conversations. great conversations about other movies and TV shows and everything. There's a whole thread where I mostly just post videos of bears being cute. So great investment. And then $8 gets you some more stuff, including you can be a guest on one of our mailbags, et cetera, et cetera. And please, you know, follow Anthony at AnthonyCanton_3. He's not here, but he's here in spirit. The DMP cooked. Yeah, tune in next time, though, as we talk about the next episode of X-Men 97. For Rod, for Deepom, for Jerome, I've been Jay Christie. Have a good one.